Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. There's no two ways about it. RDist, the first package in today's list, is very cool. RDist, as you might pick up from the name, is a little bit like rsync, and I guess technically rsh. It's that whole suite of tooling from the BSDs. And RDist is a way to distribute your files across many machines. I wish I had found out about this years ago, because this is kind of how I use rsync half the time, to be honest. Like I'll have like a folder of stuff, and I want to make sure that it is redundant, like I have multiple copies. And there are various ways to do that. Obviously, you can use backup applications like Deja Dupe, which I love. It's a great application. You can use Git. You can use rsync, which I do frequently. I mean, there's other tools still. There's rsnap, rsnapshot. There's rsync backup. There's all kinds of applications out there to help you make sure your data is being backed up, essentially. And RDist, in a way, I mean, it's kind of the same idea, but there's a slightly different spin on it. And RDist, let me find my configuration file here. RDist starts with a configuration file, which I just call rdist.host. In this file, you define first the hosts that you want to use as your distributed file system, essentially. That can be one host, or it can be lots of different hosts. And in fact, that's kind of when I was saying that RDist had a little bit of a unique spin on it. I feel like this is kind of, like, this is the thing that separates it from, I guess, just scripting rsync. You could still script rsync to do this, but this kind of has it all in one place, and it really does feel a little bit different. It feels like part of the intent here is to have a bunch of hosts. I mean, there's a hosts list, you're in your little host file, hosts equals parentheses, I have bogus at 192.168.122.82, close parentheses, which of course you might recognize by now as my virtual machine, my test box, bogus is the user, and then at, and then 192.168.122.82. Now, in real life, I would set up SSH keys so that I wouldn't have to define, and probably an SSH config, so I wouldn't have to define all of these things, but that's what I'm doing for right now. So next, you do the files that you want to sync from you know, like the files that you want from your local host to be copied over to lots of other hosts. So files equals, this is on a new line, files equals parentheses slash home slash CLATU slash downloads, for instance, close parentheses. Okay, easy enough. So we've got our host list that's going to be our destination. We got our files that are going to be essentially the source. And again, these files are from localhost. And then you've got an instruction line, which is $ curly brace files, curly brace, dash greater than, so it looks like a little arrow, and then $ curly brace hosts, close the curly brace. Next line, install dash o remove, in my case, and I'll talk about that in a moment, slash home slash bogus slash test rdist dir semicolon. Okay. So that means that I'm invoking the install subcommand of rdist. So I'm saying I want you to install the files listed in files onto the hosts that are listed in the hosts. Install dash option, or dash O rather, which I think stands for option. This being BSD, they don't really bother with useful, helpful, long options. That's more of a GNU innovation, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why BSD just does not like long options. I wish it did, because long options are absolutely the best. We should all use long options. They are self-describing. They are very obvious. If you want to shorten them later, once you understand what those options are, you can do that. But first use the long option. So anyway, dash O, I guess it stands for options. Remove, that's the key word. I'm saying to remove files from the destination that aren't on the local host. You don't have to do that. I'm just saying, in my imaginary scenario here, I would want that file on that remote host to always reflect the exact state of my local host. There, I wouldn't want any extra files over there that I don't also have here, and I would therefore assume that, and if I deleted something here, I want it to be deleted there. I would assume that anything extraneous over there is errant. I wouldn't want that there. Okay, so that's a very simple configuration file. You can look through the man page and find out a lot of different options and for the configuration and for the instructions. The command to make this happen is rdist dash capital P in my case, because I'm not providing a password. So I'm asking rdist with the dash capital P. I'm saying prompt me for a password. Again, no long options in this world, so just deal with the short options. Dash capital P means prompt me for a password. In real life, as I said before, I would set up SSH keys so that I could access that remote host without a special password, without telling rdist to prompt me for it. Probably I would set it up even without a password on the key, because really, ultimately, I want this to just run. I would probably be running this as a daemon. I wouldn't be running this manually, so I would just do rdist slash usr slash bin slash ssh. That's because by default or something, rdist uses rsh. And so, in fact, let me look this up in the man page here. Yes, okay, so it says to use any other transport method than RSH, use the dash capital P option. Okay, so I lied. Dash capital P is not to prompt for the password. It stands for rdist d path. No, sorry, it stands for transport path, capital P, not lowercase p, transport path. So you see, again, dear listener, why long options are really, really useful. If that had been dash dash transport dash path or dash dash path or something like that, I would never have mistaken it for a password prompt while describing what the command did. I wouldn't have mistaken the lowercase p for a capital P, because it would have been dash dash rdist d dash path and dash dash transport dash path, and it would have been really obvious. Long options are super, super important. I highly encourage writing them into your scripts and your applications and using them more often than not. It helps you later, and it helps other people reading your code or your instructions. Okay, anyway, rdist dash capital P for transport path slash user bin SSH dash lowercase f as in file, which does indeed point to a file, rdist.hosts in my case. And if I run that from the directory containing rdist hosts, I mean, I might want to give it a full path in real life, then it copies everything from my downloads folder, in this case, to bogus at 192.168.122.82, and does, you know, essentially an install command such that everything in downloads goes into a subdirectory called test rdist dir in the home folder of this bogus username. So it does prompt, I guess, by default for the password. I mean, I shouldn't say I guess. I mean, it clearly does, because it does. So I guess that is the default behavior, because I don't have any extra options there. It prompts you for the password if it doesn't have the password, and you type that in, and it copies. And if I SSH manually into bogus at 192.168.122.82 and do an ls on rdist test rdist dir, there's the entire one file that I had in my downloads folder copied over onto this host, containing, you guessed it, the text hello world. So yeah, that's rdist. I think it's really cool. I mean, it is like an Ansible script for rsync, except it just is. That's what it does. Rdist is rdist. You do a fancy configuration file, you list as many hosts as you want. I mean, this is really kind of configuration management in a way. I mean, it doesn't quite have the same precision that Ansible or, you know, Chef or Puppet or whatever have, where they can kind of determine the you know, certain states of the machine. Does this thing exist? Does that thing exist? If not, you know, are these the same? If not, let's replace that, or let's turn this service on or whatever. But I mean, for simple configuration management, like literally if you're just like, you know, if you've got a lab of computers that you want to make sure have the same .dot files installed on the home, within the home folders, then I mean, this could be the way to do that. Or if you've just got a machine that you want to have, you want it to be redundant to some other machine, rdist could be a way to just transparently do that. Advantages, I think, as I've said, it could be run as a daemon. It could just kind of be something that was always on, and it could just happen. Or you could run it manually just when you're ready. Lots of different ways to do rdist. There's, you know, it is just basically a fancy or a different take on rsync. I don't think it's exactly a replacement for instance something like Git, where you have version control and you have record of every transaction that occurred and so on. So I don't think you would use it for something like that. But then again, maybe you wouldn't want to use Git for something simple like what you would use rdist for. I mean, you might, but I mean, that might be a little bit cumbersome. But I could honestly see rdist being used for flat file HTML website, you know, where you've got your master local folder that is your website, and then you go in and make your changes, and then rdist synchronizes everything to the remote host. I mean, that could be a way to do that. I mean, again, maybe you'd want to do that with Git, actually, but maybe not. You know, it just kind of depends on your use case. So rdist is super cool. I was really, really happy to find out about it. I wish I'd found it much earlier, because I think I would have used it for a lot of the different things that I do with mirroring folders or drives, or not a whole drive, like not imaging a drive, but, you know, making sure that everything on a specific drive is also on some backup location or some device that I'm going to take out with me, whatever. Okay, next one is RPPPPoE. So just for the record, that's RPPPPPoE. That's Roaring Penguin PPPoE client. That is point-to-point protocol over Ethernet. This is the protocol that kind of rose up after, I don't know when it actually became a thing, but it was kind of like during the ADSL era, which, I mean, might still be your current era. It was for me until 2019, I think. I think in 2019 or, geez, maybe it was actually 2020 that I got fiber installed, and haven't obviously looked back since. I hope I never have to look back. But when ADSL was more of a thing in my life, yeah, it was very frequent that PPPoE was the method of connecting to the internet service provider. And that was because they were using point-to-point protocol, but it wasn't point-to-point protocol over phone lines anymore. It was over, well, I mean, I guess it technically is still over a phone line, but I mean, you're not dialing in and connecting to a modem. You are doing this as on a wide area network. So this is RP, Roaring Penguin, PPPoE. It is the fully compliant implementation of RFC 2516. You can check out both of those things if you want. I'm not using it. Even when I was using ADSL, it was built into the magic box that the internet service provider brought to my house to connect to. So even then, it wasn't like something that I had to do on my machine. But it is kind of cool in retrospect to know that there was an RPPPPoE command, and that in theory I could have connected directly to my service provider that way, possibly. It kind of depends. A lot of times they have their own little special requirements, but that's kind of cool. Because I mean, basically, I mean, probably more than likely, the or not more than likely, but there's a non-zero chance that the little embedded firmware on whatever magic box the ISPs do give out, it's probably running embedded Linux, and it's not impossible that the RP or that the PPPoE application would be RPPPPoE. I guess I'd have to look at like Tomato and the other sort of distributions for that sort of, you know, replacement firmware stuff to truly confirm that. But I mean, either way, non-zero chance, could be exactly RPPPPoE, could be something else. Anyway, it's cool to know about. RPC bind. I think we already talked about this when we were talking about NFS and how easy it was to set up on Slackware. RPC bind is one of the components that ensures let's see what it says. This is a network daemon used to blah blah blah. Daemons that offer RPC, such as the daemons for NFS, tell RPC bind on what port they're listening. RPC network port numbers may change each time the system is booted. So yeah, RPC bind is the network daemon that manages connections to RPC. So it's the component that is kind of keeping track of who's using what or who's on at which port. And that way, when you're requesting a specific service, you get routed the correct, you know, to the correct port. Not something you're likely to use directly, but it's something that you're using indirectly anytime that you do set up an NFS service, or I guess anything else using RPC, which frankly, I don't even know what that would be. Haven't really looked into it. Okay, next up is rsync. Rsync, as I was just saying at the beginning of the episode, rsync is kind of like, it has been my go-to, directly or indirectly, my go-to, really my backup application, I guess. I mean, that's basically what I use it for. You could use it for other things. I mean, like I said before, with rdisk, you could use it to like push files to a web server. You could use it to just copy a bulk of files over to a thumb drive or you know, whatever. So yeah, rsync is kind of a handy thing to know about. It is an application that copies files, and it does so in a very intelligent way. So it's not just like copy or SCP. It looks at the destination and it looks at the source and compares the two places. If it's got a source directory, let's say of your downloads folder or something, it takes an assessment of all the files in the source directory and then looks at the remote or rather the destination. And if there's a difference in the folders or in the files within those folders, it makes them equal. It makes them the same. That might mean overwriting a file that is less recent than the one that you're copying over, or it might mean creating a new file altogether, or it might mean removing a file from the destination, provided you're telling it to do that. And there are a lot of different options for rsync. You get to control how it behaves when it encounters differences between your source and your destination. The cool thing is, and I keep saying source and destination, and I say it that way because it doesn't have to be local host to remote host. In other words, it doesn't have to be the computer you are sitting at to a computer you are not sitting at. It can be a computer that you're not sitting at back to your local host, the one that you are sitting at. It could be between two remote computers that you're not at either of them. You just have access to them because they're two different servers on your network, and you want to ensure that the files on server A are also on server B. So there's a lot of flexibility with rsync, and that's quite a nice feature. So unlike rdist, rsync has long options. So they're actually self-documenting. You can read through the options in someone else's rsync command, provided they use the long versions, and kind of get a feel for what they're doing. But I think one of the easiest ways, especially within this format here of a podcast, is to just kind of do a couple of rsync commands and see how it works. So I'm going to go into a temporary directory here, and I'm just going to create two folders. One's going to be called server A, and one's going to be called server B. Why not? Okay, so we've got two empty directories, and I'm going to put a file into server A. That's how we'll start. I'm just going to do echo hello world into a file called hello.txt. That's in server A. So now let's start with something that essentially won't work. I mean, it won't fail. It just won't do anything. We'll just do a really basic rsync command, which is literally rsync space server A slash server B slash return. And it tells me that it's skipped the directory dot, so it skipped this directory. And if I do an ls-r, capital R here, then I have still server A containing hello.txt and server B containing nothing. So basically nothing happened. And it's a bit weird that rsync accepts a command that has no sort of point. I don't know why it does that, but it does. It allows you to rsync one to another without actually doing anything. So that's one use, but not a very useful use. Here's the classic, or at least to my mind, the classic rsync command. Not much more complex, but infinitely more useful. Rsync dash dash archive server A slash server B slash return. Now if I do an ls-r, I suddenly have server A containing hello.txt and server B containing hello.txt. So the archive is it's sort of a meta command almost, or a meta option in a way, because essentially it is running rsync-rlptgod capital D on your source and destination, which if you sort of decode all of that, the R is recursive, dash dash recursive, dash dash links. So recursive means, you know, descend into any subdirectories. So if we had another directory within server A with yet more files in it, then those would have been copied as well. Dash dash links says to copy the symlinks as symlinks. So if there's a symlink somewhere, like an alias file, it's not going to go and find the real file and copy that. It's just going to copy the symlink, pointing to possibly a non-existent destination over on your server B or whatever. Okay, so dash capital or dash P and dash T, that stands for permissions and time. So it's going to preserve the permissions of the files that it's copying and the timestamps that it's copying. And then what do we got? G, O, and capital D. Let's just look through here and try to remember what those are. G is, well, you know what I'll do is I'll reveal them as I come to them. Okay. Ah, yes. Okay. Group and owner. G, group, preserve the group, preserve the owner, dash O. And then dash capital D is the same as dash dash devices and dash dash specials, which in turn stand for preserving the device files and preserving the special files, if there are any. So that's what dash dash archive is. And as the option itself kind of implies, I mean, it is what you have is what you end up with on the other computer. It's a snapshot essentially of exactly your source, whatever you've defined as your source, and it places that onto the destination, even if that doesn't always make sense. Like I say, I could have like a, it wouldn't work in my example, I guess, but I could have a, well, actually, no, it wouldn't. I could contrive a way for it to work, but it won't. Or it's not worth it. Anyway, I could have a symlink, for instance, to a slash storage folder on my server A, right? Because slash storage maybe exists on server A. But if slash storage doesn't exist on server B, then even though I've copied an archived version of everything on server A to server B, it's not going to know from that symlink. You know, it's if I were to follow that symlink on server B, it would be a broken symlink because there is no slash storage. And that's fine in some cases, like if that's what you want. And in several cases, that is what I want. I don't really so much care about like all the different internal logics of symlinks, because more often than not, the destinations of those symlinks are being preserved elsewhere anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Or they are being preserved over on server B anyway, and so again, it doesn't matter because it does resolve. In some cases, though, it might be imperative that those symlinks are are preserved, in which case you wouldn't use the dash dash archive. You would use the options specifically that you want, and you would allow links to be copied as their you know, target files rather than as symlinks. And so in other words, you would not use the dash dash links option. But the dash 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 archive is the sort of the standard for, again, in my mind, that's kind of the standard way of using the command. But there are a couple of cool options that are good to know about. I mean, certainly dash dash ACLs is important. Dash dash xadders could be important. The dash dash ACLs preserve ACLs and implies dash dash perms. Dash dash xadders preserve extended attributes, at least to the extent possible. I don't know what happens if you use that onto a file system that doesn't have the same extended attributes. As far as I know, you just lose the attributes in that way. I could be wrong though. Maybe it stores them in a meta, you know, file somewhere and restores them when you come back. I'm not sure. I haven't tested that. There is a dash dash delete and a whole array of other delete options, like dash dash delete before, dash dash delete during, dash dash delete delay, dash dash delete after, dash dash delete dash excluded. A bunch of different variants on what you want to remove from the destination. And so we can demonstrate that by, let's do a touch file server B. We'll just call it 1.txt. I'll just leave it empty. But now I'm going to do the rsync dash dash archive because it's easy. And then I'm going to do dash dash delete server A slash space server B slash. So now remember, I've got an extra file in server B. I've got hello.txt, which is supposed to be there. But then I've got that 1.txt, which who knows where that came from. All right, do an ls dash r again. And now we're back down to just hello.txt in both server A and server B. Yeah, because it found an extra file on in the destination that wasn't in the source, it deleted that file. Now, I could do a touch of server B1.txt and then touch server A1.txt and do rsync archive delete again, and then do an ls-r again. And now they both have 1.txt because they both had 1.txt in them. I could do an echo of this is a file into server A slash 1.txt. So now that's different. I'll do the archive delete command and do an ls-r. And again, they both have 1.txt, except there's one important difference, and that is if I do a cat on server B 1.txt, now that's no longer an empty file that has the text, this is a file. So it's been updated, in other words. Which brings me to another subcommand, which, so the dash dash delete before, I mean, that deletes extra files before the transfer, receiver deletes before the transfer, not during. Yeah, and then there's delete during, so that deletes during the transfer and so on. So it's basically when you want it to press the empty button on the trash can. Like, do you want that, you want it to look at the destination and delete everything and then copy everything over? Or would you rather do it on a one-by-one basis as files are getting copied? Or do you want it after everything is settled? Whatever. Okay, so that kind of makes me think of another one though called dash dash update, which skips files that are newer on the destination or on the receiver, as they say. That's probably the better, I should switch to that. I don't know what the opposite of receiver is. Giver? I don't know. Anyway, a sender. Let's say that we've done an emacs. No, let's echo rather. This is new text. This is net new text. That sounds more official. And I'm gonna pipe that into server B 1.txt. Now I'm going to run rsync dash dash archive dash dash update server A server B. Now I'm going to do a cat on server B, and that text has this is net new text, but in server A, if I cat 1.txt, I've got this is a file. So in other words, dash dash update tells rsync to only you know, to only change the files that need to be brought up to the timestamps on the sending side. If there is a timestamp that is later on the receiving end, on the destination, then don't touch that file. I don't know. Let me look. I'm gonna try rsync --archive --delete --update. Server A, server B. No, actually, you know what? I'm gonna try that. archive --update --delete server A, server B. Oh wait, that wouldn't matter because 1.txt exists on both ends. Yeah, okay, never mind. That was silly. There is one more. I mean, there's so many great options for rsync. I mean, this is why it's such a great application. There are so many ways to use this one command. It is doing one thing and it is doing it very, very well, except it's doing it really, really well in lots of different ways. And the option I'm thinking of is exclude. And there are a couple of different variants of this. There's exclude based on a pattern, and then there's exclude -from, and that reads your exclusions or your exclude patterns from a file. So I'll just do it here on the in the terminal within the command. So I'm gonna do rsync --archive, but then I'm gonna do exclude, and we'll do what do I have in server A right now? Oh right, they're both txt files. I mean, I could still do a pattern, I guess, but then we'd have to keep track of it. So yeah, I'm just gonna touch server A/2.html. So I've got a new file. I got hello.txt, 1.txt, and 2.html. That's in my source. That's in server A. So if I do an rsync, I've lost my command now, rsync --archive --update. I'll keep --update for kicks. But then I'm going to do --exclude --*.html, server A/server B/. And now if I look in the directories, I should not have 2.html in server B because that's been excluded. And yep, it has been. There's no 2.html in server B. Simple as that. And then it's the same deal, really. Like if you do it from a file, you just line delimited list of things that you don't want rsync to consider or to do anything with. And you can do that again just by literal file name or by a pattern like *.txt or --*, to skip all the dot files, or you know, whatever. So that's really useful, and there are, as I said, a bunch of other useful ways to use rsync. I could go on and on about it. It's one of my favorite commands. I think it's one of the top commands for Linux. I mean, if there's a, you know, top 20 list of Linux commands people should have available to them, rsync would, for me, it would be on there. It's just so useful. Although, I don't know, maybe rdist is starting to edge in on that. I'm not sure. Before I walk away from rsync and go get a cup of coffee, which you'll be doing in a moment as well, I hope, let's talk about one little trap in rsync that will catch you out if you're not careful. So if you noticed, I kept saying server A/server B/. The slashes at the end of a folder in rsync are super, super significant. It's a little annoying at how significant it is, but you do have to be very careful, and I'm going to demonstrate why that might be. So if I do rsync --archive, server A, no slash, space server B, no slash, and hit return, and then do an ls-r, I now have a server A file, directory, called with hello.txt, 1.txt, and 2.html. But I also have a server B. Within server B, I have a new directory, and that directory is called server A. So I've got server B with hello.txt, 1.txt, wait, a directory called server A inside of server B. And inside of that server A, there's hello.txt, 1.txt, and 2.html. So in other words, what you do if you fail to include the slash, you are also copying the directory. All right, I'm going to trash the extraneous server A. I'm going to do the same thing, rsync --archive server A, no slash, server B/, and luckily, that gives us the exact same result where we have server A as it should be. Server B, oops, with an extra server A directory in it, and then all the files within server A inside of there. So it's essentially like the slash no slash thing is, I think, most important when you're looking at, well, really both, but I mean, mostly in the source, because you're telling rsync whether you want to copy the directory and everything inside of it, or everything inside this directory should go into this directory. The way I typically think about it for myself is that they should either both have a slash or they should neither have a slash. That's not true necessarily, because I mean, it's really up to you. What do you want to do? Do you want server B to have a folder in it called server A? If that is your intent, then it would make sense for you to do server A no slash and then server B slash. Like that sort of linguistically makes sense. No slash and then slash. But generally speaking, you kind of can't go too terribly wrong if you just remember either both of them have a slash or neither have a slash. But once you sort of get used to what those slashes mean, and again, it just kind of means whether we're looking at the directory or whether we're looking at the things in the directory. If it's got a slash, we're looking at the things inside the directory and then go from there. If it also helps to remember the difference, I kind of think of really when you write, you know, server A or source or my files slash, you're essentially writing server A slash asterisk. You're kind of saying everything inside of that direct, you know, the slash is kind of implying a wild card. Whereas if you don't have a slash, you don't have a wild card. It's just you're looking at a directory, and that's what you want rsync to take that directory, pick it up, and put it, you know, copy it over into the destination, the directory included. So I don't know, just watch out for that. And if it doesn't make sense, I think it made sense the way I explained it. If it doesn't, just try it out. Like the cool thing about rsync is that it can be local, it can be remote, it can be remote, remote, it can be local, 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 remote, remote, local, doesn't matter. So just make two empty directories in your file system and play around with it. See what happens to look at the results. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. I mean, your files literally don't even have to have any contents in it. You can just use empty files if you're just practicing, like, how do I get my things from here to there? Now, once you start looking at how things get updated based on timestamps and differences in files and so on, then yeah, put some contents in the directory, in the files, start changing them around and seeing how they act. But I think it's relatively straightforward, to be honest. The idea essentially is I want the files over here to look like the files over here, or rather over there to look like files over here. And then you have options to control just how, you know, how strict we are. Like how much, like, you know, what if it's newer over there? What if it's something that's over there and I don't even know what it is? Like, how do we deal with those edge cases? But generally speaking, it's just about copying a bunch of files from here to there. And it's nice because there are so many options. You could just use SCP and just say, hey, just copy everything from here to there. And that's, you know, don't think about it. Just do it. Like, if it exists over there, don't worry about it. Just copy it anyway and just overwrite. But rsync, you don't need to do that. So you're copying a bunch of files. Half of them are already over there. Well, guess what? You only have to copy half of the files. It can speed things up a lot, and it can also just serve to make sure that your files are aligned. It's a great tool. Try it out. Not yet. Go get coffee first. We'll come back, finish up the show. And I'm back with my coffee. Hopefully you've got coffee as well, and indeed, hopefully you're back. The next package is, confusingly, I think, called S-Nail. That is Sierra-November Alpha Indigo Lima. S-Nail. I say this is confusing because the application that it contains is male. That's Mike Alpha Indigo Lima, actually, and then an X at the end, so X-ray. So it's male X is the command, the literal command that it contains, which is aliased to just male on your system anyway. So if you've ever installed Slackware, certainly, and then typed in male, as I think it does remind you to do that, then you see a message on within your system from Pat Volkerding, the maintainer, the creator and maintainer of Slackware. So that might be the only time you've ever used male X or male, but really male X from the snail package. And that's honestly kind of enough. Male is not a very, very robust application. And I don't mean this in a negative way. I'm just saying in today's world where people talk about having hundreds, thousands of emails, of email messages, I think that male X, it's probably not ideally suited, maybe, arguably, for dealing with all of that email. I think that there's an argument against that, interestingly, because male X doesn't really care what it where it looks for mail. It is really just a parser of the inbox format. You point it at an inbox file, and it does all the parsing. It figures out where the headers begin, where the header ends, where the body is, what's an attachment, and so on. That's what it does. It parses all of that information. You can read message. It'll list the messages. You can read them. You can respond to them. So I guess that's not all it does. That's the main functionality of its sort of inbox service is parsing an inbox file. You can then invoke it to respond to email and so on. It would require a lot of setup, but I mean, then again, so does Mutt. And you certainly have the option to just point it at an arbitrary inbox file. By default, it wants to look at var, spool, mail, and then your username. But you can, with a dash F or a dash dash file, you can point it to any inbox file, and that becomes the file that it parses and writes back to in the event that you've done like a reply or you sent a message. So there are mechanisms, lots of mechanisms to help you kind of manage the modern workload or the expected modern email load, I guess. And that's cool. And there are even ways to do this like from within the application. So you can do male X, just male X. Well, okay, so then it tells you that there is no mail. But then you could say like male X dash F my.inbox. And then you're looking at my.inbox instead of var spool mail username. Now, you can literally try that right now and you'll be relatively unimpressed because it won't work. I mean, it will work, but it will sort of end. It will end quickly. For instance, male x dash dash file tilde slash temp slash my.inbox gives me doesn't even give you a message, actually. It doesn't even tell me, can I do a dash dash verbose? Sort of. Yeah, not really. Yeah, so, I mean, what it does is that it checks the non-existent file, in my case, of my inbox, and finds no messages there. And so it quits before it sort of visibly starts. But you can get around that. If you just want to be in an interactive session of a mail application, you can do that. So male x dash dash set empty start equals true space dash dash file, and then the path to, let's just say it's my.inbox. It tells me that there's no mail and that there are messages in the error ring manageable via the errors command. Okay, well, let's type in errors then. What do we have there? Yeah, we do. We have a message that there's no such file as my.inbox. That's useful. And then a message that I've just looked at, which is that there are messages to in the error ring and to look at that. So for something a little bit more substantial, I'm going to just copy a sample inbox file over to my temporary demo directory, and then run male x dash dash set empty start equals true dash dash file in my inbox. And in this sample inbox, there are five messages, one from Alice, Bob, Ted, Bob, and Ted. Alice is at the top there. She's numbered one. So I'm going to just type in one at the prompt, at the MailX prompt. And there's her message. Bob, check out the new Network X release. You and Carol might really like it. Signed, Alice. And that's to bob@gov, date Thursday, 16 June 2005, from alice@edu. There you go. That's that. I could, in theory, respond to this with the R. I type R, and then I'm placed in a sort of a here doc, where I can type in, hey, this release looks really great, thanks. And then control D to get out of the here doc interface, and I'm prompted to either send the message yes, no, or empty. No response at all, it'll let me recompose. So I'll just say yes to that. I mean, it's not going to send. I don't have an SMTP server set up for this, but that would be the theoretical workflow. Or anyway, it's a theoretical workflow. I mean, you can hit N to go to the next message, P for the previous, I think. I could be wrong about that. And I never could figure out how to get back to the sort of the inbox view, or the list all messages view. I just couldn't, I can't figure that out. I don't see that documented anywhere. It's probably somewhere super obvious. I was not able to find it. So anyway, that's the interactive mode, and probably not, realistically speaking, the way most people are going to use MailX. The place where MailX truly excels is the non-interactive mode, meaning that you can do things like, I don't know, echo hello world, and then pipe it to mail X with, the person you want to send it to, and a subject line and a from line. You know, you're defining the header, and then hit return, and that'll email something straight out of a terminal. I think that's the more likely scenario for mail X, or at least that's the reason it's still a very, very relevant application, I guess, is because when you need to script the sending of an email, like, this is a great way to do it. I mean, it might be the only way to do it. I mean, there's always another way. But, I mean, this is the way. Like, that's the easy, easy way to do it. I mean, you still have to set up SMTP and all the things that you would need, like authentication and stuff like that. So it's not magic. It's not going to just send email just without any kind of setup. Or, I mean, it may try just with your local host as your domain name. And then, I don't know, like, it really depends on what you have set up, obviously. But that's what I think MailX is really, really useful for. It's really nice that way. You can get, you know, errors emailed to you, log files emailed to you. If you set this up to actually send email out, then you can script an email. And it is very cool. I've done it. I had a batch emailing script that I was using for a very long time at an organization that wanted to send out bulk emails, but was just, for whatever reason, the ISP, it just wouldn't let it happen. I mean, not for whatever reason. It's an obvious reason. They interpreted that as spam. In this case, this was legitimate, like, email stuff that people actually wanted. And I tried to get a mail list set up. People just couldn't figure that out. And so what I ended up doing was just scripting a MailX to send emails every, I don't know, you know, like 1 to 10 seconds, it would send a new email. And so the ISP didn't see that as spam, because it was just a bunch of different emails being sent at different times. And the list of, you know, 50 or 80 or 150 recipients got through. So in other words, probably not a replacement for Mutt or Alpine, if that's what you're looking for, but a very good tool for automated emailing, if that's what you need. Okay, that's enough about SNAIL. Let's talk about Samba. I like Samba. I really do, in theory. I mean, no, I like Samba. But in practice, I don't find that much use for it lately. I used to rely on it heavily because it was the one sharing protocol that was kind of built in to be pretty easy for most operating systems to use. And that's across the board. Linux could do it easily. Windows could do it easily because it was kind of Samba is a re-implementation of the SIFS protocol, which is a Windows thing. And I shouldn't say that so definitively. I know that SIFS and SMB are somehow intertwined. I don't know how the inheritance goes, but Windows developed a thing and Samba re-implements that thing. It led to a really serious lawsuit that stretched on for a while Microsoft was trying to say that their protocol should not be usable by any other system other than Windows. And they took people to court over it, which, like, we should not forget, as users, we should not forget that Microsoft did that not that long ago. I mean, well, it's been 10 years now, but I mean, that's not that long ago. Maybe a little bit longer, who knows? But I mean, it's within a lot of people's recent memories because those people were being threatened with lots and lots of, monetary penalties. I mean, it was a big deal for a lot of people. We should not forget that. We must not forget that because Microsoft could do that again. Any big company could do that again. We see it kind of all the time. Companies trying to go back on what they've said, companies trying to suddenly gain a business advantage, quote unquote business advantage, by really harassing just normal everyday people. Very, very bad, very dangerous. But the Samba team admirably did not back down, and they made it happen. They re-implemented everything from scratch and made a system that's really pretty easy to set up. Now, having said that, the system has migrated from what I got, from what I knew when I was using it on a daily basis. It still does support SMB SMB password, whatever it's called, apparently for backwards compatibility, but it apparently really, really leans heavily on TDBSAM now. And that is new to me. Like I've never used that before, I don't think. Or maybe I did, but not in a serious way. So that's fairly new. The Samba configuration mostly occurs in smb.conf, which is located in the /etc folder, and /etc/samba/smb.conf. But what you're going to want to look at initially is smb.conf-sample, which is it's got a bunch of the sort of essential options in the configuration file, plus a couple of really, really useful example configurations for what you're sharing. And that's, I think, the tricky part here. There's kind of within this one configuration file, you're configuring sort of how this server shares stuff, but then you're also in the same configuration file, you're kind of going out into a different mode and configuring individual shares. So just kind of keep in mind that there are sometimes, or that there are two different things happening in this conf file. And that may not make all that much sense if it's the first time you're doing it, because it just all looks like a configuration to you. But eventually it might make sense when you start to realize, okay, well, everything in the global section is already done. I don't have to worry about that ever again because it's finished. What I really need to worry about is all the stuff in the individual shares. So in the global section, and you might miss that it's global, it's brackets global, close brackets, but it's after a big block of comments that wisely advise you to read the PDF available online on how to configure Samba. So go read that if you're doing this for real. But the Slackware or whosoever example conf file this is quite good. So you can do you can set the work group. It defaults to my group, which may not matter to you if you're not running any Windows networks, you know, like if that's not what you have, if there is no work group, then just calling it my group is fine. If your organization runs a lot of Windows boxes and maybe some Windows servers, you might want to check, or maybe you would already know. So that's the work group definition. Then there's the server string. This is just sort of a description field, really. Server role is a standalone server in this example. There is a hosts allow section. This is relatively new as well, I feel. And here you can define basically by giving as much of a network as you want to provide. So in other words, you could say 192.168.122. to indicate that everything within that subnet can access this server. Or you could say 127. And then that says everything within the 127 network can access this, which of course would be 127.0.0.1. And so on. So you can do that. There's a guest account option, which you can do if you want. PassDB backend. I think by default, this uses TDB SAM, although you can use SMB password for backwards compatibility. TDB SAM requires no further configuration. It's just going to read local users off of your machine or something like that and just kind of handle everything for you. Samba password, which is what I'm used to, you used to have to manually add users and passwords sort of as in this sort of separate kind of like Samba only club. It was a bit weird. So it feels like this is probably an upgrade all in all. I'm just not familiar with it. And then that I think is the end of the global section pretty much. That I mean that you know the essentials. There are then the share configurations, or rather the share definitions. And those occur in sort of INI configuration format, just as the rest of it did. So it's bracket homes, for instance. You don't have to call it that, but let's say you did. Bracket homes, close bracket. And then there's a set of options that you can provide to talk about who can access a specific shared directory. So for instance, and this is where it gets kind of tricky. I mean, you start to run into who's got permission to see what questions, and it can start to get a little bit messy. But you could do, for instance, bracket TMP for a temporary directory, close bracket. Comment equals, this is temporary space. Or storage space, that's a comment. Path equals slash TMP, that would be literally the temp directory of your Linux file system. Read space only equals, well, no, probably it's a temporary storage space, you probably want people writing to it and getting stuff from it. Public equals, in this case, let's say yes, everyone can get to the temp directory. And of course, we've already restricted like the scope of who can access this at all with our host list. So, or our host list, let's call it a host list. And so that in theory sets up Samba. Now on my, and that's on my virtual machine, of course. So then on my actual local machine, I'm going to get a new Dolphin window and type into the URL bar here, SMB, or I guess URI bar, SMB:// I'll do 192.168.122.82. And it comes right up with a directory called homes, which doesn't have anything in it because I didn't set that one. And then one called TMP, which if I click on it, there's a bunch of old package, slackbuild.org packages. There are some random sort of log looking files, you know, temporary files, things that you would expect to find in a slash TMP. That's it. You've set up a Samba server. I mean, that's just the temporary directory. Fiddling around with permissions for individual users and whether you want directories to be browsable or not, and whether you who you want to allow into those places, and then what kind of permissions they have on their own folders is part of the equation too. So it can get a little bit messy, but if you start with sort of, you know, certainly on a safe network, if you start with like opening up a bunch of stuff at first, and again, this would be on a test network, a virtual machine or something like that, and it's seeing what you can access, seeing what kind of things you can set in the configuration file to start clamping down on that access, and you kind of start to get a feel for it. The man pages and the configuration documentation is essential. I mean, there's a bunch of different options, and there's a lot of really, really good ones. I remember I think I was using Samba for kind of a Dropbox setup. And by Dropbox, I mean students in a classroom would submit their work to this shared server. They could write into the directory, but they could never get anything out or even read the files within that directory. It was super, super useful, specifically for like digitized tests. People would turn in the results of their work to this Dropbox, and they couldn't see other people's work, but everyone could drop a file into that folder. And then the teacher, of course, could go into that folder and get the papers out. So it was really, really useful. It was really easy to set up. It all happens pretty much in one configuration file. I mean, you've got other options. You can make this as complex as you want it to be. And this is a very simple example. I mean, really simple example. But there's so much more you can do. I mean, you can share printers. You can share files. You can create remote logins that people can, so that they can log in and have a lot of their data, you know, sort of on some centralized Samba server that then appears on their computer and so on. It's all very cool. I mean, not from just sort of fathoming how the programmers figured all this stuff out, and the Samba team have a lot of very, very, very smart people on it. But it's also cool just, again, because it is essentially a re-implementation of a Microsoft technology, there's a lot of widespread compatibility. Like if you have a mixed environment and you need to share work, you don't have to go out to the cloud, you don't have to go to the internet, you don't have to go to Google Drive, you just set up a Samba share. And people will have access to each other's files. They can create folders. They can put their stuff into common places. It's so, so simple. And I don't understand why so many places outsource this kind of stuff. It's like it all exists. You can do this yourself. It's not impossible. I mean, yes, you probably should pay someone to do it for you and correctly, but pay them on site, have them there, or not on site, but, you know, as a part of your organization, bring them onto the payroll. Do not outsource this stuff. I mean, really, we need to stop outsourcing stuff. I mean, we can outsource stuff, but we're all outsourcing to the same two or three organizations. And by we, I mean they. People are outsourcing to the same couple of organizations, and those businesses are not working well. I mean, I don't know if I have to mention CrowdStrike here and Microsoft and outsourcing, but I mean, really, it's not working. Well, some of those took longer than I expected, so I only got through 6 packages in this episode. That's all right. I'll just pick up the rest in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
find it very perplexing.